Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Muslims in the United States and in many parts of the world have been facing increasing exposure to discrimination, fear, and even hatred. It's the result of growing Islamophobia, fallout from the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, and the resulting war on terrorism. We don't have to go very far to find examples. A mosque torched in Joplin, a Missouri legislative attempt to ban tenets of Islamic law, opposed Halloween Facebook posting by Washington University students branded offensive by Muslim fellow students. Elsewhere, there have been reports of physical attacks, verbal assaults, humiliating profiling against Arab and Muslim Americans. The Council on Islamic American Relations, or CARE, the nation's largest Muslim civil rights and advocacy organization, has issued a report on the subject of Islamophobia. It alleges an Islamophobic industry with access to at least $120 million for the sole purpose of demonizing Islam and Muslims. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio to talk about the report and its conclusions, Faizan Syed, the executive director of CARE St. Louis, and John Chasnoff, former program director of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Faizan, let me begin with you and ask you to give us an overview, kind of the Cliff Notes version, if you will, of the report.
So something that's interesting that you mentioned is that after September the 11th, you would expect there to be a spike in anti-Islam or anti-Muslim attacks in the United States. And that's what we saw after September the 11th. But what's unique is that after the first few years, those percentage of attacks actually kept going down and down and decreased. And then in 2008 and 2009, we saw another spike in those bias-motivated attacks. And we've seen that height now more than even after September the 11th. So it make one ask, well, why would these bias attacks happen after September 11th go down and then all of a sudden for no real apparent reason go back up? So the report itself, it follows 34 different organizations, groups, and individuals across the United States who are organized and exist for the sole purpose of demonizing Islam and Muslims. From 2008 to 2011, they were able to get at least, not the most, but the very least that we've been able to track, $119 million for the sole purpose of attacking Islam and Muslims. So we feel that part of the bigotry and hatred that exists is not just because it exists, but rather it is an orchestrated, well-organized, well-funded thought process that is being pushed on the American public.
But it's not a monolithic organization. It is comprised of many separate groups and individuals.
Right. We created an inner core, which is about 34 different groups whose purpose it is, and then about an outer core of 37 different groups whose sole purpose isn't to demonize Islam and Muslim, but they create an echo chamber effect for this inner core. An example of this could be in the most recent election, you have many Republican candidates who were not, their purpose isn't to attack Islam and Muslim, their purpose is to get elected, but they would use the same footnote and their same messaging from the Islamophobia industry, it's the inner core. So they are creating an echo chamber from this inner core. And this is something that the report highlights those groups, those individuals, and it says who they are and what they do.
The report also takes a look at public perceptions of Islam. And what did that tell you?
Well, one of the nice thing that we noticed in the report is that every year CARE judges Islamophobia in the United States on a 10-point scale. And we saw a small but yet very positive decline in Islamophobia within the last year. It went from 6.4 down to 5.9, which is something very positive. And we've also seen in the most recent Boston bombing attacks that many of the young people under the age of 30, they did not link those attacks to Islamophobia or Muslims. Rather, they saw it as individual terrorist attacks, which is something very positive, especially amongst the younger groups. So this is something that's very nice that we see happening, and we hope that this trend continues in the future.
John, I want to emphasize that you are no longer with the ACLU, but the kind of things that Faizan is talking about, that come as no surprise to you.
No, it really doesn't. I think we saw after 9/11 that there was a trend towards this kind of demonization of one group of people, mostly newly immigrated to this country. And the ACLU began on a national level to confront this type of issue. And locally, even before my time at the ACLU, Brenda Jones, who was the executive director there, put together a Muslim rights task force starting in about 2006 to confront some of these issues and make sure that people who are here in this country have their civil liberties protected.
What do you make of this spike that Faison alluded to that occurred in 2008, I think?
2008 to 2009.
Yeah, 2008, 2009.
Well, it seems to me that there were certain factions in this country who decided to exploit this issue and to work on it for their own advantage. And so as this industry developed that was pushing Islamophobia, like-minded people found an opportunity to further their careers, to gain public attention by pushing this kind of fear and demonization of the Islamic community. And I think it took them a few years to get organized, but once they did, you saw this spike develop.
Yeah, to add to what John said, when I said 2008, I look at my notes, actually 2010. And the reason is at that time, those were also midterm elections within inside the United States, and also that's when there was the Ground Zero mosque controversy that was going on at that time. So this fringe group was able to use both of these situations in order to gain more public support and get into the mainstream. You remember in 2010, almost every news outlet was talking about the Islamic Community Cultural Center being built near the sites of the Twin Towers. So this is also when we see the Islamophobia industry getting into the mainstream and using sometimes politics as a way of making their message more mainstream within the country.
How is this $119 million being spent, or how has it been spent?
The money has been spent in multiple ways. Some of it's been spent just for pure profiteering, but it's also been spent in, for example, 2008, there's a film called Obsession that was mailed to over 30 million people within inside the United States, again, to sway voters to vote in a certain direction. We've also seen billboard ads. We've also seen research done by basically shell groups in order to create research that supports their type of program. So these are just some of the ways that the funding is used. And also it's been used in one particular way, which is the introduction of 78 bills in over 29 states that target the practice of a specific religious group within those states, particularly Islam and particularly Islamic civil law. So we've seen this phenomena happen over the last 3 years now. And Missouri is one of these states that had one of these anti-Islam pieces of legislation come in. So these pieces of legislation are based off of core legislation, which was made by David Yashelmi, who his group has been called a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. But yet these pieces of legislation, their purpose necessarily isn't to make the practice of Islamic civil law illegal within the states they're being introduced. But what they have an effect of doing is they have an effect of creating mainstream discussion on that Islam or that Islamic civil law is here to take over the United States or that it's a threat to the United States. And that's really the negative of these pieces of legislation, that they might not be enforceable if they are passed, but they create that cultural change within the states that they're introduced into.
And John Chasnoff, is that what you found? I know you've done during your days with the ACLU. Is that what you found with regard to the legislation in Missouri?
Well, yes, it definitely is. I think that there were certain legislators who were more or less duped by these national organizations who were pushing fear and concern around really non-existent problems. And then there were other legislators who thought that, you know, it was to their political advantage to jump on board. So 3 years ago, we saw the first bill introduced here, and that one specifically singled out Islamic law and said that it would not be allowed in the court system of the United States. Well, it was obviously unconstitutional to single out a specific religion for separate treatment. And so they got more sophisticated in following years and have begun to talk more generally about foreign law and outlawing foreign law. But what we've seen is it's a perfect example of what can happen. When you start to demonize a community and single people out, it not only affects that community, but then it has repercussions for everyone else. And as they change these bills to talk about foreign law and more generally foreign issues supposedly infiltrating our country, you saw effects on foreign marriages, foreign adoptions, and a lot of civil repercussions to these bills that are really negative for everybody.
Of course, here in Missouri, it was always referred to as the Sharia law bill, which was, I guess, kind of a media device to simplify what was going on. What is it about Sharia law that legislators are afraid of?
Well, I don't think there's any rational reason for their fear. You know, religious groups put together self-governing laws for themselves. You know, the Jewish people have kosher laws that affect their dietary practices, and the Catholics have canon law. So there's nothing really unusual about Islamic groups having a law that governs their internal religious functioning. That's all that really this is. But there's been created this sense that there's a conspiracy of Islamic folks who want to take over our court system, and that somehow or other they're going to take this purely religious law and have it affect our civil law in the United States. It's really a made-up problem. They can't cite any instances of this happening, but you know, as protecting ourselves from some future invasion of a problem, they've created these local legislation.
Faison, how do you see it?
I have to agree with John on a lot of these on a lot of what he said, that these pieces of legislation are introduced, and many of the legislators who support them, they don't even know what they're supporting. We've had multiple meetings with elected officials, and we would ask them, well, why do you support this piece of legislation? And many of them said, well, we don't really know. We just signed on to it, or we don't really have any specific case. In fact, John and I even went to Columbia, Missouri, and we had a discussion with Representative Paul Kirkman, who introduced the law, I believe, 2 years ago, if I recall correctly. And during that discussion, we were asking him, so why are you introducing the law? What are the issues? And rather than citing real issues, he was discussing that there's this one company that makes guitars and they use trees from a certain other country, and that country, those trees are endangered. So this company cannot buy that wood anymore, and they can't make those guitars. And we're all sitting in the audience saying, like, what are you talking about? What does this have to do with anything? And the same thing he mentioned, lobster fishing in Alaska, that in Japan, certain type of lobsters are endangered. So these American companies are not allowed to fish those lobsters. And because of this, they're not able to function. And we're just sitting there like, where is this coming from? What does this have to do with the religious issues, or what does it have to do with these other issues? And what we realize is that many of these elected officials are introducing legislation, not necessarily because it's good legislation or because it makes sense, but because perhaps they find some type of political benefit in it.
But, you know, some of the things that we were hearing during this time was that the Sharia law calls for stoning women who are accused of adultery and cutting off the hands of people who are accused of theft. That's the kind of thing that we were hearing.
Right. And one of the tactics used by the Islamophobia industry is to use very specific cases in the Sharia, the large idea of what is Sharia law, and use those as a way to create fear and animosity towards Islam and Muslims, such as the examples you mentioned. But in reality, what's practiced and allowed in other countries is that civil law, as John was mentioning, which is through marriage, divorce, inheritance, burials, all these types of things. And also in the United States, you can never have a foreign law supersede American law. So if there is some Chinese law that said that somebody can go kill their neighbor if something else happens, that would not be allowed in the United States. Same with any other piece of law. And there's no Muslim groups within the United States, no groups or individuals or Islamic centers that are calling for this type of hysteria that's purported by these legislators or by these very inner core Islamophobic groups.
Well, John, if there is hysteria, an accusing finger would have to be pointed toward the media.
Well, I think that the media reflects what's going on in the trends in society. And when these things gain a foothold, then it's true that the media picks it up and serves as something of an echo chamber to spread some of those ideas. But I don't think that I haven't seen instances of the media itself being biased. I think it's just reflected and reported on what's been going on.
All right. We have to take a break now. We're listening to John Chasnov, the former program director of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. With me in studio is Faison Syed, the executive director of CARE St. Louis. That's the Council on Islamic Relations in our area. It's a national organization, and we're talking about a report recently put out which describes Islamophobia in this country. It's something that is very much with us, and we'll be talking more about that when we come back. We'd like to bring you into the conversation as well, so give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd like to send us a tweet, we'll take that too at STL on Air. Back with Faison and John in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on Islamophobia in the United States and in our region in just a moment. First, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom following today. A U.S. Court of Appeals panel stayed a Missouri man's execution a little more than a day before he was set to die. The state was scheduled to execute Alan Nicholson in about 12 hours for killing businessman Richard Drummond in 1994. But a three-judge panel of the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals stayed the execution because of insufficient representation. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon signed legislation today to provide up to $1.7 billion of tax breaks for Boeing if the company chooses to assemble a new passenger plane in the St. Louis area. Lawmakers quickly endorsed the economic incentives at a five-day special session of the General Assembly last week. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation with Faizan Syed, the executive director of CARE St. Louis, and John Chasnoff, former director of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri, former program director, I should say, of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. Faizan, let me come back to you with regard to local examples of the kinds of things that we're talking about. We've mentioned the legislative aspect of it. What about some of the other things that have been going on?
Well, Islamophobia and hatred that's preached in any country, in any society, has real consequences and has real damages that are done to individuals. The greatest example within the state of Missouri was the burning of the Joplin Islamic Community Center. And what many people don't know is that ever since that Islamic center was built, it's always been the subject of multiple attacks. People have gone by and shot shotgun shells at their mailbox. They burned down the sign of that masjid twice. There was an attempted arson 1 month before the actual building was completely burned down. Even when I went to Joplin, Missouri, the day after it burned down completely, there are still people in trucks driving by and cursing at us there as we were going through the salvage and the rubble. So what people have to realize is that this type of speech and this type of organization, this type of money that's being spent, has real consequences, and it does affect the lives of people. So that's one consequence that we work with. Of course, in good news, though, the person who burned down that Islamic center, Jebediah Stout, was caught recently, and now he was also denied bail. So that's something that we're very positive with. Another, bringing even closer to home, I live in Kirkwood. I've been living in Kirkwood my entire life, went to Kirkwood Middle School, Elementary School, High School. And our local representative, Rick Stream, he sent out a very disturbing email to the Republican list, quoting Churchill and basically saying that Muslims are almost like a plague wherever they go, that they go into different societies and destroy the societies, and all these really negative types of statements within that email, which is very troubling to us because here's this elected official sending it to the Republican email listserv, and we don't know how many people got that email or what their response to that email is, and that's just the email we discovered. So we wonder what type of conversation are going on behind the scenes, behind closed doors, that directly talk about Islam and Muslims, and will this type of conversation, will these types of misunderstanding and stereotypes produce further negative attacks on the Muslim community, and now the Muslim community, the larger community as well.
John Chasnoff, this, of course, is nothing new, not only with regard to the Muslim community, but to any minority community in this country.
Well, I think that's really important to point out. We've had waves of immigration throughout our history. You know, the Irish came over during the 19th century. Eastern Europeans immigrated here during the early 20th century, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the remarkable things about this country is that, on the whole, we've been able to do a good job of integrating new arrivals here in this country into the population, with the exception, I have to say, of the African-American community, came here under very different circumstances.
Sure.
And I think that the Muslim population was part of a current trend of immigration, and that process of integration and understanding was happening here. And with 9/11 and the disruption that it caused, I think it threw us off track. But I think it's important for people of goodwill to remember that this is a process that is very American, that's fundamental to our nature. We've always welcomed immigrants to this country, and that people of goodwill need to come together and work with the Muslim community to make sure, and with our our other members of the society to make sure that there's understanding and communication and that we learn to accept each other.
One of the most recent incidents that has captured a lot of attention and sparked a lot of comment has been the Facebook posting, as I mentioned earlier, by some students at Washington University at Halloween time. And there were several of the students in costume holding toy guns and pointing those guns at someone who looked like it might have been Osama bin Laden. The school was very slow to respond to that. Mm-hmm. It ultimately did and apologized for it. Faison, what's your take on that?
My take is, in the United States, it's still socially acceptable to say things about Islam and Muslim that wouldn't be socially acceptable to say about other religions. We can see it happening either in the most recent elections. We can see it happening in what some news outlets say. And we can also see it happening down to the level of even universities. So what's happening is that there's an overwhelming misunderstanding of Islam and Muslims across the United States, and that results in statements and actions that people do thinking it's out of jest or joking or whatever they might justify it as, and not realizing the consequences of what they're doing. So these young students at WashU, they took a photo. I'm sure they didn't think much of it, but they're not realizing that if they took the same type of photo, but they're imitating Nazis in Germany or if they're imitating other groups, then they would realize how offensive it is. But yet still to this day, we have a society that still believes it's socially acceptable to do these types of things. CARE and the ACLU and many other organizations, we were to try to make the community understand the negativity of this type of behavior and the negativity of this type of speech as well.
I have to point this out. One of the students who took offense to this Facebook posting asked the question in a blog or a piece that she had written about it, saying, how do you think the school might have reacted if a black or a Latino had been involved in the photo? Mm. And the response to that from someone who was posting a response on Facebook said, blacks and Hispanics didn't kill 3,000 on 9/11. Mm-hmm. That's the mindset.
Right.
Your thoughts.
And that's exactly the problem, because still to this day, many people will blame the majority of Muslims for the action of specific secular political groups within inside the Muslim world. And I think this distinction is very hard for people to understand or realize, that when you see a terrorist attack happen anywhere in the Muslim world, which is 34 countries, over 1.6 billion, if any individual who has any ties to being Muslim does any type of attack, they're immediately labeled as Islamist, they're immediately labeled as whatever you want to call it. And what effect that has is that people are unable to distinguish between the acts of political players who are doing terrorist attacks in order to create a change within their country or society, and the religion of Islam and the Muslims who follow that religion. A good example of this is recently within the Boston bombings, that the two men who did those attacks, they didn't cite religious reasons for doing those attacks. They didn't say, well, one day they woke up, they read in the Quran, and then they decided that was their religious obligation to do these attacks. Rather, they cite very specific political reason for doing the attacks, whether it's the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, whether we agree with those reasons or not. But the thing is, as the media, I believe that the media has the responsibility to do more to explain why these people carry out these attacks, why these people do what they do. And there have been multiple examples, and I can cite a few maybe later on, of how these people who are doing the attacks, they're not doing it because one day they woke up and they read the Quran and they realized, oh my God, we've been doing this entire religion wrong. Rather, this is what we're supposed to do. But rather, it's because they're living in a country that are oppressive, they're living in a regime they're totalitarian, they're living in places where they don't have the right to express themselves freely, or they're being occupied by other nations or other countries. And because that, that's what pushes people to carry out extremist attacks. Not only in the Muslim world, but any country in any place in any society in the world. When you have oppression, when you have injustice, you're going to have people take on these actions. But in the United States, you've had that action always be linked to Islamists, always be linked to because they're Muslim, always be linked to their religion, rather than us discussing those political reasoning why.
John, comment?
Yes, I think one of our important principles in this country is that we have freedom of association, and your associations don't necessarily make you guilty of a crime that someone else commits. So if I were to rob a bank, it would probably not be reported in the newspaper that a white Caucasian John Chasnoff robbed a bank, or that a Jewish American John Chasnoff robbed a bank. We've moved past that for some groups. But when we report on Muslims who, commit crimes, make mistakes like everybody else, we tend to lump the group together. And I think one of the phrases that I find most damaging in this regard that is used in the media is a phrase like Islamism, mm-hmm. so that we conflate the religion as a whole with a very small extremist group within that religion. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a mistake, a generalization that we make too often.
We have a lot of listeners who want to get into the conversation. And I think while we're on this part of the subject, we'll bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. He has another take on some of the reason for this Islamophobia. Go ahead, Scott. You're on the air.
Yeah, I think he said there was a spike in Islamophobic activity in 2008. I'm wondering if that has to do with the campaign and election of Barack Hussein Obama. I remember his middle name was played up a lot by his opponents.
No, that's a very excellent understanding that it is the Islamophobia industry, especially in 2000 and more so in 2010, has been able to use this fear of Islam and Muslims in order to win political votes. For example, they claim that Obama is a Muslim. And they claim that Sharia law is taking over the country. In 2010 is also when these anti-Sharia law legislations were introduced. 2010 is also when the Grand Jair Mosque controversy started. 2010 is when Pastor Terry Jones was burning the Qurans in Florida. And all that built on top of itself in order to create grassroots momentum. And that's also in 2010 we saw the rise of the Tea Party. We saw a huge shift from Democrats controlling the House and the Senate now to Republicans controlling the House and the Senate. So this is when Islamophobia becomes mainstream, when people see that they can get tremendous results, tremendous political gain or economic gain using this religion and this group of people for their benefit.
I'll go back to the phones, John, unless you have something you'd like to add to that.
Well, just one comment on that. I think it's interesting the position it puts someone like Barack Obama in when confronted with a question like that. So his background makes it very clear that he's not Muslim. But if he were to jump up and down and say, I'm not a Muslim, it almost sounds like, well, would that be a problem if he were? And so the question is framed and the attitudes are framed in such a way that it's a no-win situation for people of tolerance.
Let's have Kathy join us in this conversation. She calls from Festus. Go ahead, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to put ditto marks under most everything that's been said. I stand 100% against what's happening with the Muslim community and all the communities that are experiencing this hate speech. And I just want to point out that this is one of the oldest forms of manipulation of large groups of people for a person's own personal gain is to throw out a few fear messages about a group and then let that fear take over the minds of the people, and then they'll just go out and do all those hideous things and accomplish what a single person or group wants to accomplish, like the Salem witch trials, for example. I mean, this goes way back in our history, and you think we learn. You think we figure it out after a while.
Well, there's a more recent example than that, and I'm thinking of Nazi Germany, where you take a minority and you demonize it and you use it for your own political advantage, as Faison has been saying. Mm-hmm. Kathy, thanks for the call. Comment?
Just one thing I'll add to that. It's a statistic. Gallup recently did a study of over 50,000 Muslims in 55 countries and asked them, do they support suicide attacks or terrorism and these types of things. What the study found, that was done by Gallup, is that 93% of Muslims polled across the world rejected suicide attacks and rejected terrorism as a strategy. Those 7% that did support it when they were re-polled in focus groups, they always cited political or secular reasons for their support of these tactics. So again, there needs to be a distinction made by not only American Muslim, but by media outlets within the United States to distinguish between those political reasons and what those reasons are, so that way the American public understands this is why it's happening, and the religion of Islam itself. And if that distinction is not made, then this type of misunderstanding is going to continue and it's going to grow with time.
Let's have Steve join us from St. Louis County. Steve, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, Don. First, I'd just like to say how much I respect you and this program.
Thank you.
I personally abhor extremism in any faction. It can come in the face of the Christian faith, the Jewish faith, those that profess no faith at all. But it surprises me that there seems to be a lack of a unified voice speaking against the extremist elements that I think are the real fire underneath a fear of any group of individuals that profess an extreme position. We just don't hear, it seems, from the Muslim community an explanation or
condemnation of those.
Precisely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's have
Faizan. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thanks for the calling. And Faizan, go ahead. We hear this a lot. Why isn't there not more outright condemnation of the radicals?
So 2 points. First, of course, myself and my imam and the Muslims that I know and the Muslim scholars that I know, all of them condemn terrorism. They condemn terrorism on Friday sermon. They condemn terrorism during their conferences. They condemn terrorism on the streets. They condemn terrorism in National Public Radio here in St. Louis Public Radio. Muslims have been condemning terrorism ever since the time the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In fact, the condemnation of terrorism and extremism is actually built within the religion itself. The issue and the challenge I would ask your caller and your listeners is to ask yourself, how many of your listeners have gone out and actually looked at what the Muslims think? How many of them have gone to the mosque or gone to these conferences, gone to these public forums? Because again and again, Muslims do condemn it. But Muslims do not have a news station like Fox 2 News or CNN in which they're going to 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, condemn terrorism. The second point that I'd like to make is that we have a language built into us as Americans that is not appropriate to understand these problems. So we call these people extremists. We call these people fanatics. We call these people X, Y, and Z. And some of them are. Some of them are religious. But the majority of them are involved in political fighting, political conflicts that makes them do these attacks. For example, Pakistan has been Muslim for at least 20 years, right? At least 20 years. It's been a Muslim country. But yes, suicide bombing in Pakistan has not started until after 2002, 2003. So if suicide bombing was a part of the – if terrorism was a part, then why did it start at this particular day? Why not before? And the reality is because the political situation of that country has changed due to the United States invasion of Afghanistan, a huge immigrant population moving from Afghanistan to Pakistan, drone attacks in Pakistan. So that is what is creating these attacks. And the language that Americans have of understanding why these people do these attacks is inherently wrong and is flawed and is dangerous. Because if we cannot even speak the language as why these attacks are going, why these terrorist attacks are happening, why are people becoming quote-unquote extreme, you will never fix the problem. You will do things such as have more drone strikes in Pakistan. You will do things such as create more invasion or invade this country or kill this person, but not change the fundamental problem that people do not have security, that people do not have fundamental liberty, that people do not feel that they can express themselves except through violence, so on and so forth. So this is a language that as a society we need to work and develop and change. There is a faction that is extreme. There are people that are, but that's not the majority of these individuals.
I want to take more calls, but I have to take a break. You've just been listening to Faizan Syed, the Executive Director of CARE St. Louis. CARE, of course, is the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Also with me in studio is John Chasnov, a former program director of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. Back to continue our conversation and take more of your calls. We have a number of folks waiting. Please be patient. We'll get to you when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back. We continue our conversation on Islamophobia in this country and this community with Faizan Syed and John Chasnov. Let's go right to the phones. Folks have been so patiently waiting. We'll bring in Tom calling from Jennings. Go ahead, Tom. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to say that it seems to me like the problem isn't that, and of course there's horrible bigotry and things. I don't condone any of that, of course. And stereotyping either, but I think the problem isn't that people don't know about Islam. I think the problem is that people do know about Islam. And we know from looking at countries that are run in this Islamic fashion that freedom of speech is not valued, people are executed for drinking alcohol, women don't have any rights relative to men. We know what Islam is. And people are opposed to it. I think that's where the Islamophobia comes in. Now, of course, every individual who says that they are Islamic doesn't reflect all the values of these countries and these negative things, but they kind of have a burden to explain that they don't, because I'm just going to assume, if I see you and you're Islamic, that you support the values that were in the country that you came from. And those values are generally in opposition to mine, and I am not a Christian, so I'm not coming from that angle. But I'll take my comments off the air. Thanks.
All right, Tom. Tom suggested that talking about people who have come to this country. Were you born in this country, Payson?
No, I came from Pakistan.
Yeah, okay.
Lived in mind,
right? Yeah, I think you're the one to at least start the response to Tom.
All right, just a very quick response. The majority of these so-called, quote-unquote, Muslim countries are not Islamically run countries. They do not follow the Sharia. Most of them are secular countries. Iraq was a Baathist country. Syria was, of course, another Baathist country. Egypt was a secular nationalist country. Pakistan is, quote-unquote, the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. But these countries do not follow Islamic law, quote and unquote. Neither does Saudi Arabia. These countries sometimes use Islamic law as a system of controlling their population. But if anybody who even knows basic history from the last 2-3 years has seen the Arab Spring, what is the Arab Spring about? That these people are revolting against the oppressive regimes of Islamic states within their countries? Or are they revolting against tyrants who are oppressing them within their countries? So I don't believe in the last caller statement that these people are from Muslim countries, look how the Islamic countries are treating them. There is no Islamic country in the world today. The last Islamic country died off in 1924, and there hadn't been one since. So those countries that are majority Muslims are not practicing Islam, and they're actually practicing multiple other religion, other political systems. So I would just say that.
And John Chesnoff, of course, the problem most recently in Egypt is the concern that it was turning into an Islamic Republic, and that was what's caused the latest upheaval there.
Yeah, I think that's true. There was a lot of rational fear and also irrational fear that was circulating around the whole situation in Egypt. But when you talk to people from the Muslim community about that situation, you see the various cross currents of thought and the complexities of the traditions and the histories and the political philosophies of people from that part of the world. And it's not easy to stereotype any of it at all.
Let's bring in Jeff calling from St. Louis. Jeff, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. A previous caller was complaining that he wasn't hearing a unified voice against the violence perpetrated by alleged Muslims. I am hearing that voice. I've been hearing it. I listen to public radio all the time. I've heard numerous spokespersons on various public radio shows, you know, talking about a truly unified voice across the country, in mosques, in communities, and on PBS, Charlie Rose, Religion and Ethics News Weekly, and other shows, they're there. The voices are there. John was speaking, I think, charitably on behalf of the media, but I think mainstream media has been downplaying those voices, perhaps in deference to their customers. I don't know what, but that voice is there. That unified voice against violence is there in this country.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Do either of you want to comment on what he has to say?
Well, yes, I would. I think that talking about the media's role in this, one of the things that's a phenomenon in this country in recent years is that we don't have a unified media either. Mm-hmm. We have a very diverse and fragmented media in many ways, and people find the types of communication and the types of messages that they want to hear. So I do think that if people look, they'll hear just what you said, that there is a unified message coming from the Muslim community about these issues. But if they're only listening to a particular TV station or only getting their news through a particular source, then the information they get is necessarily biased because it's so incomplete.
Claudia at Scott Air Force Base has a media-related question or comment. Let's go to her at this point. Go ahead, Claudia.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The conversation's kind of leaning towards the media comment that I had. And I just wanted to say that as long as there is biased reporting, you know, such as several major networks where a lot of Americans get their information from, they're going to need a bad guy to blame it all on. And it just so happens that, you know, Muslims are relatively a religious minority in this country. And, for example, Fox News is not going to report, you know, on the minority side because, let's say, they have a vested interest in, you know, the conservative community, which are largely Christian. So, you know, that's a reputation that they need to protect. So, obviously, you know, they're going to, you know, blame it on a bad guy, and they're not really concerned with making the differentiation. that maybe the extremists aren't, you know, the example or the best example of a Muslim believer. And I want to compare it to kind of how the reputation of a certain faith is protected. And I'm talking about the Christian faith in this example because of, you know, the Westboro Baptist Church. Everybody knows, you know, that, you know, they're just portrayed by the media as a bunch of crazies. And Americans are able to make that distinction even though they are Christians. But then again, we don't lump all Christians into the Westboro Baptist Church category. So I think more of the unbiased reporting that we get from public news, you know, like St. Louis Public Radio, is necessary in order to break that stereotype and defy what a lot of the media that, you know, reports on the bias network is helping to perpetuate.
All right, Claudia, thanks so much for the call. Faison, you want to comment on Claudia's remarks?
I think she's on the money on that there are some news stations that do have a vested interest. And actually, even what John said, the media isn't monolithic, just like the origin of Islam is not monolithic. And as the world develops more, you have more and more media outlets that can cater to those people who already have pre-beliefs or whatever they might have. And then it just reinforces what they already believe. So I would have to agree with Claudia on that.
And John, it seems to me that it's like trying to prove a negative, that any groups that are targeted for the kinds of things that we're talking about are perpetually on the defense. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can argue whether or not there's been a loud enough voice in opposition to some of the radical ideas that we hear from time to time. But that is a difficult position to be in, is it not? Playing defense all the time?
Oh, sure. It's that, you know, that age-old saw about, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? Mm-hmm. There's no answer you can give that takes you off the hook when you're given such an accusatory premise to begin with. And I think that the Muslim community has been in that situation now. And I think the way we break through that is really by reaching out and getting to know people. People are complex. Communities are complex, and when you get into the richness of a community and get to understand the ebbs and flows and the streams of thought that are happening, then those kinds of questions just fall apart.
Well, Ted seems to have some ideas on this, so let's go to him. Ted, calling from St. Louis, you're on the air.
Hi. I do want to pick up on that point. And the question I want to ask is about practical steps that people in St. Louis can take. I've been working on a project since 2001 that involves Muslim, Christian, and Jewish schools working together, private faith-based schools coming together and having students do problem-solving activities that challenge them to work together to figure out solutions. And these games called in-team games measure how well kids do at helping each other solve problems. And so that's one attempt of building bridges, and I'd like to hear about more attempts that people are doing to try to build a sense of community in a diverse society.
Ted, thank you so much for the call. Well, that brings us to another facet of the report that we've been talking about, and that is that you have recommendations for members of the American Muslim community as to how to deal with this situation, and also some recommendations for the rest of us for how to deal with it. So, Faison, go ahead and tell us what some of those are.
Well, I'll answer both of those in two separate parts. So the American Muslim community, there's a lot of action that the Muslim community in America can do. First of all, they can get more engaged in local communities. They can get more engaged with their neighbors, with their PTOs, where their children go to school. And they can open up their Islamic centers. They can do open houses. And as American Muslims, it is really up to us as a society and as a community to do more outreach on an individual level and an institutional level. Many American Muslims who are especially immigrants, like all immigrants, they came to the United States to make a living, take care of their family, send money back home. But now we need to go beyond that. And as American Muslims, we need to really step up our efforts to do interfaith work, to do on-the-ground work, and to have more people who can speak on Islam and Muslims in a more diverse crowd. As a larger population, it is important that individuals try to learn more about the tenets of Islam and the fundamental beliefs of their religion. It's hard for people to live in the world today and not know the religious beliefs of 1.5 billion people in the world. it's very against the notion of Americanism that you can have neighbors who are Muslim, but you don't try to learn about their faith or invite them to your home or participate in interfaith dialogues. There's actually a program coming up called Jewish and Muslim Day of Service, which is on Christmas Day. It's not just for people of Jewish faith or the Muslim faith, but people of all faiths or no faiths to come and volunteer on Christmas Day. So this is an effort going on in the city of St. Louis. But unless there's a concentrated effort to, first of all, learn more about each other and to learn about those groups and individuals whose sole purpose it is to attack and demonize others and then keep them on the fringe of society, as you would the Ku Klux Klan or any other group. If there's not both of these efforts done, then fortunately this type of misunderstanding that leads to hatred will probably perpetuate within the society.
John, I wonder how many people out there really realize that the roots of the great religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are the same.
Well, sure. I think it's the Muslim community in particular that emphasizes the fact that we're all children of the book, children of Abraham. And I do think that sometimes the worst squabbles are among brothers or cousins in this case. And I think that really we do all stem from the same place, that we are very closely related historically and in the present. And I think people tend to isolate each other and forget that fact.
The ACLU all over the country has been involved and is involved in any number of cases involving the Islamophobic kinds of things that we've been talking about. Is this healthy? Does this exacerbate the problem in any way by creating this legal conflict? I'm not sure I'm putting that exactly the way, but the more we talk about it in terms of challenges in court, if this in fact tends to inflame.
Well, I'll stand up for the ACLU in this case. I do think that, you know, this type of situation has to be fought and there has to be pushback on many different levels. And some of those do take, you know, the situations in court. So when you have an unconstitutional law that's passed or illegal detentions in Guantanamo Bay that have to be confronted, sometimes the best way to confront those are in the courts. And the way we change public opinion and public policy is on many different levels, public education, legislation, but we have our legal system as a fallback here, as a ultimate protection of everyone's rights. And I think the ACLU's done wonderful work in that regard. And just to extend that thought a little bit, one of the repercussions I think that we've seen from this Islamophobic hysteria is an increase in the power and intrusion of the state on all our lives. So we've seen what's happened as a result of 9/11 and as a result of Islamophobia. We're now getting revelations that the government has been spying on us, surveilling us. You know, the NSA leaks, the Edward Snowden leaks that have come out just show us that we're really all connected. And when we begin to react out of fear and out of hysteria, we end up hurting the freedoms for everybody in this country.
We've only got about a minute left, and Faisal, we'll give you the final word on this, your final thought.
Oh, well, thank you so much for that. My final thoughts are I would encourage especially educators within inside the state of Missouri and actually across the nation to look at our report. It's on our website at care.com and also on our Care St. Louis website. To look at the report, read the report, because it does very clearly indicate where is this fear coming from, who are the organizations pushing it. And then once you understand the problem and that there are people pushing this type of fear and hysteria, then we can actually work to create a solution to the overarching problem as well.
We will put a link to your website and give folks who visit sdlpublicradio.org the opportunity to see for themselves what we've been talking about here. There are plenty of examples, no shortage of that. I think it's a 68-page report, plenty of information there. Faisal Said, thank you so much for being with us. Faisal is Executive Director of CARE St. Louis. That's the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Good to have you with us again. And also a repeat performer on this program is John Chesnoff, former program director of the ACLU of Eastern Missouri. Good to see you again. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks for having us here, and thanks to your audience.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the just-completed merger of St. Louis Public Radio and the St. Louis Beacon, its effect on news in St. Louis, and its implication for other media outlets. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at sdlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.